Hello and welcome to another episode of the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, on Smart Speaker, and of course on our podcast. I'm AD Packham and we're all plotting routes around Europe in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, we got back to winning ways on Saturday as Newcastle were sent home with their tails between their legs after Evan Ferguson became the youngest player to ever score a hat-trick for the Albion. We now go international break, where there is hope that Lewis Dunk will get his second and possibly third England caps 5 years after his first one. In addition, by the time we play Manchester United after the break, Pascal Gross could have picked up his first cap. However, as good as we were on Saturday, all the talk at the game was about how it could be Amsterdam or Marseille or Athens or home. But unfortunately, we've got some people to talk to us about that. So joining myself and Alan Wares today is a man who knows a thing or two about getting places in the shape of the director of Seagulls Travel, Darren Gallis. And we're also delighted to be joined by a man who's been covering the Europa League for years. It's Dave Beckett. Welcome back to the show, guys. Lovely to see you. Mm-hmm. And these are really exciting times, aren't they?
It's amazing. Absolutely amazing, isn't it? I think, who thought that we would ever play in Europe, let alone get the sort of draw we've got? So, yeah, can't wait. I'm sure Darren's probably finding it a bit more stressful than the rest of us.
So Darren, how's your head? Have you got any less hair than you used to have? Are you trying to look like me?
I'm making good progress. it's been challenging, exciting times. Obviously, we'll talk a lot later on, but what a time to be a Brighton fan.
I think it absolutely is. Talk about, you know, people saying, "Oh, 25 years ago we were doing this. We were bottom of the fourth division. We were this," and of course that's perfectly reasonable things to talk about. And we say this many times: the story must be told and told, you know, and passed on down generations. But you only have to go back 2 years, and people are going to say, "Yeah, when we get into Europe," and go, "What? Slow down, mate. Not yet." So you know,
yeah, say that. I was probably getting a bit ahead of myself, but we did it.
Yes, I know. I mean, how greedy of us to actually bother our backsides to actually win enough that we've made it into Europe. I mean, it's absolutely astonishing.
Now, Dave, I mean, you've been covering the Europa League for years, like you've been sent to all sorts of far-flung places.
Indeed.
I mean, there was a brilliant post on Twitter or X or whatever you want to call it this week where someone said, there's a picture of with Dean. I said, you know, 12 years ago we used to be here, and like I was thinking, actually there's probably quite a few teams in the Europa League where with Dean would have been luxurious.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I've not traveled so much on it over the last sort of 10 years or so, but I did a good sort of on Champions League, Europa League, I did a good sort of, I don't know, 14 15 16 years. And with Dean was quite luxurious. Compared to the one that always sticks in the mind was Mupa in Finland, where we sort of drove for the middle of nowhere for about 4 hours through loads of trees to the outside of nowhere. And then you just suddenly come through, you literally just driving and driving and driving, trees, 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 trees. And then suddenly there's this tiny little ground, you know, and you go in and there's a football ground and there's a whole Europa League, or it's UEFA Cup, I think, for that back then, a UEFA Cup night going on. So that was, I seem to remember that was Blackburn Rovers. And the thing that sticks in the mind with that game was David Bentley, if you remember him, who sort of his career took a big nosedive. But at the time, he was a real rising star and he was being compared to Beckham and everything else. And in their wisdom, for some reason, they decided that our flash interview area, which is where you do that sort of immediate post-match interview, never encountered this anywhere else. They put it on a sort of a gantry up a ladder. And of course, he's still wearing his football boots and everything. So all I'm thinking is just, insurance, like this is a disaster. You know, he probably was one of the most big rising stars in the country at the time. I mean, if he slips down this ladder, then that's just like that's the end of me. That's probably the end of the coverage. You know, we're done for.
But, you know, as a broadcaster, you have obligations, but the players have obligations as well.
Yeah, I think I was thinking about this earlier because I did wonder if that was maybe something that was worth mentioning. Just when people talk about how tiring it is, obviously Roberto De Zerbi's talked about this need for the two squads and everything. And I think if you've been on that sort of rotation with the teams, you do realize that, you know, there is a bit more to it. You think, oh, well, they play Thursday, they play Sunday. But if you imagine, say, the Athens one being the furthest flung, they've got to go out on the day before the game. They've got to sort of get settled in at the hotel and everything else. They'll have a training session at the stadium on match day minus one. So they go from the hotel to there. You know, they've flown out that day. They have a little training session, which they then have some media duties to do as well, which will be the manager and one player normally. 15 minutes or so of that training session will be open to the media, won't be open to the public, so there's no point in the fans going along. Then they've got the game, and then usually they fly back straight away afterwards. And then you've got another game on the Sunday. So if you're away on the Sunday, you might get back in the early hours of Friday morning. You know, it's quite tough because it doesn't matter how much you earn, they're human beings, and it doesn't make you any less tired.
Yeah, I mean, we were saying on the show last week, Al, about how, I think it was last week, about how obviously when you've got a manager like Roberto De Zerbi, who's like he's very into the details, and the, you know, he's had time to train with the team and get those details into the player and his ideas for each particular game, for each particular opposition. Obviously, because of the changeovers and the amount of travel we're going to have to do, he's not actually going to have as much time on the training pitch, which is that a worry, do you think?
Well, yeah, it's always a worry. I mean, having said that, every player does know their job. There'll be some teams, you know, whether it's a Premier League game or an FA Cup game and now also about to find out a European game as to the, you know, he'll tweak the tactics slightly. But in the great scheme of things, he'll still play his absolutely mesmerising football that no one can understand. So in that sense, you'd like to think that every player, certainly the senior ones, those that have been with him since day one, when he first came along, they'll all know their jobs. So in that sense, it's not so worrying. I think the thing that could happen, and I'll come back to you on this, Dave, if I may. I don't know how many managers have done this before, because frankly, we haven't really paid attention to it. But, you know, given, and you're mentioning Athens as an example there, it's the furthest flung one. And the players are going to be flying a few thousand miles there, play a game, come back, and so on. Would it be prudent for him to leave 3, 4, 5 players behind in order that at least not every single player has travelled and therefore is going to be knackered?
Yeah, I think that probably has happened in the past. I'm not so sure now. I mean, it's weird actually, because when I was sort of covering UEFA Cup, Europa League, it was always kind of seen as a bit of a joke, and it sort of seems to have been, you know, much more embraced in recent years. I don't know if that's just because some bigger clubs, I mean, you know, West Ham were obviously playing a step below that, and they won that last year, and you would think they'd won the Champions League the way everybody's talked about it. So, but yeah, I think that's kind of squad rotation. The famous one was Martin O'Neill sort of back in the mid-2000s when he rested because Aston Villa were in with a chance of qualifying for the Champions League via the Premier League. And they were doing very well in the UEFA Cup, Europa League, whichever it was at the time. And he sort of rested a lot of players for that and put all his eggs in the basket of he was going to qualify for the Champions League, which, of course, they didn't do. They messed up the European campaign and they then went on to sort of mess up the Premier League campaign as well. And it all backfired. So it really is it's a really tough balancing act, I think, that. And I think it's really tough when you've got this group. The one thing I would say about the group, I mean, they're great names. It's exciting. It's quite structured European competition to make it quite hard to go out, really, if you're a club of sort of Premier League stature, because normally you've got a real minnow in your group. And if you finish in the top two, you're going through in that competition. If you finish third, you're dropping into another European competition. So we're quite unlucky in a way, but we've got three clubs which, regardless of their merits at the moment, but three clubs that are all competitive. You know, you might have hoped that you'd have a very small club that was a pretty easy rotation option home and away, that you're going to beat them, and at worst you're going to finish third.
Well, that's a good thing. I mean, we're terrible against playing against teams that are going to just come and play with a low block anyway. But I mean, Darren, I mean, will you be rotating your coach drivers for the European track?
Well, we're going to be asking a lot of them because we haven't really spoken about the inclusion of the Carabao Cup fixture against Tottenham. Against Chelsea, so that needs to be, you know, accommodated. I think that would be one game where we might see some of the younger players coming into the team for that, for the rotation. But for us, yeah, it's very, very busy time. I look at the schedule and it's just, you know, relentless.
Yeah. Okay, well, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of that very, very shortly. But first, let's have a look at last weekend. Newcastle were, of course, the visitors to the Amex. And, Darren, we were just quite magnificent, really, weren't we?
Yeah, I actually thought the first 10 minutes were up against it. But once we sorted that out, they were, you know, high press. Once we got round their press, I thought Ferguson's hold-up play was something else. And we haven't really seen, I know Danny Welbeck does that, but we haven't really seen that since Glenn Murray. And no, the way he held up the play and brought the Matomas and Billy Gilmore, I thought was amazing. Van Hecker at the back. There's some players that really stepped up and taken their opportunity. And I think that's what the players need to do.
Yeah. I mean, Dave, I mean, we did see some players get... Well, actually, for Verbruggen, it was his second start in a row. The first start of the season for Joel Veltman as well, which was... and Van Hecker, of course, came back. It was... but, you know, these players... I mean, I think that Veltman in particular was one that, for me, we've probably missed him on the pitch because, I mean, James Milner, all his experience and everything else, is, obviously, that's there to be seen. But I just think that Veltman had something a little bit different.
Yeah, I mean, this in a way goes back, doesn't it, to the when you're talking about the rotation possibilities in Europe and that sort of thing. And look at the difference, really, where they've had a week to work on what went wrong against West Ham and they've changed the team. And just look how accomplished they were. And they were back. Got to be the best performance of a season, I would have thought, because even those first couple of games, you could sort of see the flaws in the team. And they've got to find the way around this sort of lack of Caicedo situation and everything else. And yeah, Veltman coming in, I mean, that just made a huge difference. I mean, did Anthony Gordon play? I'm not sure if he was out there, was he? So,
I very much enjoyed his performance, actually. But,
it made a huge difference, didn't it, having a defender there. And I sort of get the impression that that's probably, it's not really the way that Roberto De Zerbi wants his fullbacks to operate. He's not too worried about having a defender there. He likes someone that can play the midfield role very well. But, you know, perhaps he's just adapting at the moment and realising until we can integrate Baleba that he's got to, perhaps got to be a bit more defensive. He's got to have three defenders in the team that can defend because we haven't got the legs in midfield at the moment.
Well, we haven't got the midfield shield.
Yeah, exactly.
I think the game itself, or certainly our part of the game, was helped by the fact that Newcastle's press, and I say low press, didn't they once? Isn't that sort of a euphemism for bus parking? But their press was neither one thing nor the other. It was a little bit sort of half-assed. You had the three forwards sort of making a nominal effort, and the midfield then just sort of standing off, you know, I think trying to mark man for man. So you had Dan Byrne trying to swap shorts with Evan Ferguson all the way through the game. You had Billy Gilmore, who, let's face it, totally bossed that midfield. But apart from that, given that we're now, I say we, I mean these players know how to do it, it scares the bejesus out of us. And you see them coming down, you're playing around with it 2 yards from the goal line. And you think, how on earth did they get out of it? And they know exactly what they're doing. And Newcastle, to a certain extent, were falling into our trap. So I think that certainly that particular part of it helped. And once we went 2 and 3 up, it's not as though Newcastle gave up as such, but you could see them being run a little bit more ragged. And in that sense, the goal was kind of as unfortunate as it was avoidable because, you know, we had total control of the game. We were closing it out. And it would be nice for us to keep a clean sheet this season.
Yeah. Now, Alan... after the match, we had a chat, and obviously we know that Evan Ferguson was always going to get all the plaudits for, you know, becoming the youngest ever Albion player to score
a
hat trick.
We think he is. We think.
Well, we can't find any records that prove otherwise. We're waiting for Tim Carter to confirm it, but
it might be he's certainly
younger than Jake Robinson was. He was younger. Who was the other one?
He was younger than
Pete Ward. Yeah,
younger than Bobby Zamora. We haven't had as far as I'm aware, we haven't had that many 18-year-olds play for us.
Let alone
score hat tricks. Yeah, exactly. So and each goal was finished off very, very tidily. And it's
what I was going to ask was, I mean, obviously we're going to talk about Evan in a minute, but what we were saying is we knew that Evan was going to get all the plaudits, but we gave our man of the match to Billy Gilmore.
Well, like I said, as I think Dave's just alluded to, in fact, all three of us alluded to, Billy Gilmore just ran the show. I mean, he is a different beast to Caicedo. I think I wouldn't mind betting he's still got some growing pains to go through. Whereas Caicedo, I think someone mentioned that Caicedo's nickname was the octopus. Now, I never heard it being mentioned down here, but I did like it and understood the point there because, you know, no matter how far away he was from you, he could still reach out and, you know, another limb that comes out and gets the ball. Billy Gilmore's not such necessarily the ball winner, but the number of times he would just drop his shoulder and ghost past his man, the number of times he is actually, for his size, he's actually very, very strong on the ball. He rarely gets beaten off it. And Newcastle did come down here to play a fairly physical game. And very rarely, if at all, I'm sure maybe once or twice he did, but I can't think of it, 3 days later, did he lose the ball? It was a complete performance and set up Ferguson for doing what he did. Well, not just him, set up so many others, while at the same time stopping Newcastle from, you know, doing what they are capable of doing.
Dave?
Yeah, well, this is the interesting thing. I don't want to keep going back to the Europa League, but I can't stop thinking about it really at the moment. But this is the thing about the rotation, isn't it? And about and how you can work on things. And I do think the way clearly Roberto De Zerbi, they worked so much on those patterns of play. You know, you can imagine the amount of work they do all the time, perhaps even without the ball, where it is just, you know, learning that when this player moves, you two press and everything else. And that is going to be the hard thing once we get into that run of European games. So hopefully, as Alan was saying earlier, everything will sort of tick along quite nicely. If you get a bad result in there, I think that's then, you know, how do you work on it? Because you come back, you've got maybe one day. So you're traveling, and then you've got a day to prepare, you know. So that is going to be tough. But I love the way with Roberto De Zerbi's teams. To me, it's kind of like high-speed chess at the moment. And I think it's brilliant because we're watching all these teams, and I think maybe we're just noticing it more, but you watch the number of teams now that are trying to play from the back, which teams were doing before. But you see some teams now are trying to sort of draw the press in the same way that Roberto De Zerbi has done so successfully in the Premier League. And, you know, Manchester United at the weekend, they're just knocking the ball around aimlessly. There's no thought that there's actually a thought process with Albion, which is when we're knocking it around like that, there's half an eye all the time on, yeah, well, as soon as you move, that killer pass goes right up to the front and cuts out the whole midfield. Yeah. You're seeing other teams do it. And also they're just so uncomfortable with it. I mean, goalkeepers like Nick Pope, it's what a disaster. The whole sort of current vogue for goalkeepers is for Nick Pope, because he was an amazing goalkeeper three, four years ago. And he probably still is an amazing goalkeeper if you don't expect him to ever kick the ball, you know. So it's
One of your example is actually, you know, the game itself. Yes, Newcastle had a go at it. But I mean, there's one thing, you know, being able to play it around at the back. And I think that what a lot of teams doing, they're just doing it around the back four. But of course, the Albion not only then employ their midfielders to do it, that you'll get a pass from Lewis Dunk to Danny Welbeck or to Evan Ferguson. And you think, where on earth did that space come from? Mm. But the second thing is as much as other teams do their press on us, we do something completely different again on them. Completely rendering their mucking about the back as useless.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Nick Pope kicking the ball, because it led to the first goal, and it was a very poor clearance from him. Pervis Estupiñan was on it like a shot. We just like swarmed like wasps at them, and it was just so, it happened so quickly.
What kind of wasps?
Nice ones.
Okay. Right.
Blue and white stripy ones rather than yellow and black ones, you know.
Darren, did you feel at the moment Purvis got the ball that it was in, or did you just think, oh, this is going to be another one of those wasted chances?
So he passed the ball, I think, to Matoma, and Matoma put it over. With Matoma, I love Matoma, but sometimes he's not in the game and then suddenly he'll do something. He knows when to do the right pass. And him and Purvis have got a great relationship. Purvis, you don't know if he's going to shoot. And I know with Arsenal away, he shot on target, but he has a history of missing the target. So I was quite glad he passed to Matoma. But when you start seeing defenders fly in, you just hope that the attackers make the right choices.
But we did see the ball fall to Billy Gilmore, who still never scored a professional goal. And he got close this time, but Pope parried it straight into the path of young Ferguson, who finished with aplomb, Alan.
Oh, with plums and plums. I'm still of divided minds as to whether Pope could have hung on to that. It was very hard. It was hit very true.
I think the Newcastle defender, Alan, put him off. There was a defender in front of him who sort of wagged a foot. I think it swerved a bit when I was watching those replays. And I think maybe that, I'm not saying it should have put him off to that extent that he fumbled it, but I think, you know, I'll just give him the benefit of the doubt and think that it was really travelling, swerving a bit, and someone made a pretty ineffective attempt to try to block it.
A waft.
A waft. Yeah. The point about what we've got with Evan Ferguson, you could say this about Danny Welbeck, you could say about Solly Mo, because goals are coming in from all over the place. For years and years, for a long time, certainly probably since Glenn Murray retired, and probably before that, between, say, I guess probably between Murray going, you know, in 2011 and him returning 2017, we've been screaming out, oh, we need, you know, why can't we spend money on this? And my attitude is always going to be, I'd rather we had an 80 goal a season team rather than a 20 goal a season striker, because I don't care who scores the goals. So the fact that we've got Ferguson scored his first three, March is on three. Well, we've got now 12 goals in the league.
Well, Ferguson's on four now, isn't he?
Has he scored? I lose track.
Yeah, he scored against Luton.
I lose track. But my point, whatever be, I don't think it actually matters who scores. So, I mean, I think to highlight that, I'm just wondering how many times last season Purvis Estupiñán scored his first goal.
Well, there is that. I mean, Dave, on our predictions show at the beginning of the season, we predicted that after scoring 96 goals last season, that we were actually going to get into like triple figures this year. Do you believe that?
Well, there's goals just everywhere in the team, aren't there? So, yeah, I mean, it's hard to... there can't be a more exciting attacking team in the Premier League, I don't think. Maybe even, well, other than Manchester City, perhaps, but we're up there with them, I think, on the attacking front, aren't we?
Goals-wise, we've scored more goals than anyone in the Premier League so far this season.
Absolutely. So, I mean, you've just got goal threats from every angle, really. So, and, you know, even Billy Gilmore might start getting some soon because he's come pretty close a couple of times.
It'll be about time. Yeah,
Darren?
There is a weakness, though.
Go on.
Go on, Darren.
When we take corners, we don't ever look like scoring.
See, that's to lull people into a full sense of security. Yeah. And then when we get into the Europa League, we can score every corner. That's the cunning ruse.
Yeah.
See, I think
we beat the first man and everything.
We conceded against Southampton late last season. And I'm not sure if the one that Dan Burns scored up at St James's Park, whether that was a free kick or a corner. But apart from that, it's not as though we concede that many from corners either. I think it's just one of those things that corners, as much as it excites the crowd, are kind of slightly overrated set pieces.
Well, you know me, I'm still thinking, ooh, corner. Like, well, expecting Harry to still be there, but, you know.
Go on. Yeah.
But, let's move on. Basically, we went in at halftime, 1-0 up, and we came out. Again, it was a fast start from us. And actually, for the second goal, Darren, I actually thought that Billy Gilmore had actually miscontrolled it at first, but he managed to poke it through to Ferguson, who still had a hell of a lot to do. But he fired it home from, 25, 30 yards?
Yeah, I think the way that Ferguson took that second goal was similar to Glenn Murray when he scored a few years ago against Villa. It was very similar, and I think Ferguson, you know, he just looked up and he found that corner, and the rest was history.
Dave, I'm getting a bit annoyed about it and fed up about it, but every time I see Evan Ferguson mentioned in the press these days, it's not about his hat trick, it's like who he's going to be signing for. Yeah. Isn't that a bit disrespectful to us?
Well, yeah, I totally agree, really. I mean, I'm working the media, but I'm a Brighton fan, and I just generally get fed up of the, like everybody else, I think, that of everything, you know, being viewed through the sort of prism of the so-called big six stroke seven these days with, you know, Newcastle and their finances as well. Yeah, I mean, I suppose, you know, if I totally divorce myself from the Albion side of it, then it makes a good story, doesn't it, to talk about, you know, these players are going to go somewhere. But it's the kind of entitlement, if you like, and just the sort of the acceptance that this is the natural course of things, that, you know, he should move on to such and such a club. Fortunately, I think with Evan Ferguson more than the others, there seems to have been a little bit more of a move from people within the game to say, well, he's absolutely in the right place at the moment and shouldn't be in a rush. And yeah, I think the experience of a few people that have left would probably suggest that's absolutely spot on, really, especially if you're only 18.
Well, I think what also helps Evan Ferguson is his dad was a professional footballer as well.
Absolutely.
So can therefore guide him. A lot of, well, if you think of the people that obviously are surrounding Evan Ferguson versus those that are surrounding Moises Caicedo, you know, chalk and cheese, isn't it? The well, we don't know the exact story. I mean, everything's sort of, you know, second, third hand. But let's face it, he went to Chelsea, which was, I think, probably just most people recognise was a poor move, considering Liverpool was on the table as well. But I mean, and Evan Ferguson himself has already rejected Liverpool once upon a time. One's got their head screwed on. One, I think, just wants to bolster their bank balance a little bit. One's going to work hard for their career. One has really now got to work hard for their career.
Yeah, Dave?
Well, I think with Evan Ferguson, that without sort of wishing to add to the hype, but I mean, he scores all sorts of different goals, doesn't he? I always think that, you know, he reminds me really of Alan Shearer when he was first coming through. And I think if you look at Harry Kane when he was Evan Ferguson's age, I mean, he's much, much better than Harry Kane was. So, you know,
he
the
was
sky,
Orion, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, the sky's the limit, really. You know, Kane was one that I did a lot of Spurs games when he would have been one of their rotation options in the Europa League, you know, back in the day. And there was never really anything about him that you thought was that special, which probably shows what a terrible judge of talent I am. And that's a real curse on Evan Ferguson. But, you know, on the flip side, Connor Wickham was looking pretty amazing once when he was in the Championship and won the Player of the Season, you know. So you never know quite how a player's going to develop. But he looks like he's got everything, really.
He does. But I think one thing that a lot of people have got to be patient with is that, of course, he's 18. That's part of the story. And he's still on his journey. He's still on a massive learning curve. That when you hear De Zerbi speaking about Ferguson, you hear him talking about someone who still has an awful lot to learn. Yes, he can stick the ball away, but he's got other aspects of his play that I think De Zerbi wants him to improve with.
Yeah.
You know, the link-up play and what have you. So there will come a time, just because he's human, that he'll have a drop-off in form. He won't have a good game. He won't... And, you know, and then because... And I've seen it on social media, and it drives me around the twist that a player can only ever be judged by their most recent game, which is absolute hogwash, obviously, is that people must be patient for the time that happens, which hopefully it doesn't too badly, then when his form is going to dip and he's going to need to refine himself. But for the moment, yeah, we're just going to enjoy his, you know, his prowess at the moment.
Yeah, but what you have to remember is as well that Ferguson isn't necessarily the first choice starter, and
that as
you know,
well.
He's all, I mean, the first few games of the season, Danny Welbeck started. Obviously, he's picked up a knock and was unavailable at the weekend. But you know, we've also just signed one of the hottest young talents in Europe. You know, so which is another striking option. So you know, Evan will play a lot of games this season, but he's not going to play every game this season.
Oh, far from it. Far from it. But
Darren?
Yeah, I was just saying, when you're talking about Fatty, I think I read something that his Instagram followers are more than Brighton have themselves.
Well, if that can actually translate in terms of if you could quantify skill and talent, then we've signed quite a player.
Yeah, I know.
Apart from that, I think it's a lot more than ours as well. Sorry, Dave, go on.
Yeah, well, I was thinking sort of about Fatty at the weekend when I was watching that game. And, you know, you think he must have been watching that thinking, I'm going to get so many chances in this team. And I also thought the great thing about a match like that was that, you know, we come away, it's a really good win against a really good team. And yet you know that Roberto De Zerbi is probably still going to look at that and be pulling it apart and thinking, well, you know, we can still do better in midfield and we can still make probably the biggest weakness in a way in a match that we you know, we bossed and we won comfortably, still making perhaps not quite the right decision on some of the breaks, you know, with that final ball into the box. Mm-hmm. And then that's where you think, well, someone like Ansu Fati, presumably, if you've got the pedigree he's got, he will make the right decision. He will put the ball in the net. He will pick the right pass, you know. So I think it's frightening how good the team, if the two that have come in are as good as we hope they can be and as history suggests with the recruitment record, then frightening how good Albion could be this season.
It's exciting, isn't it? It's so exciting.
It and don't forget as well that, you know, when we've got Fati to come in, I can't remember what my point was there.
I just want to pick up on something Dave said there just now. I mean, as much as we saw, I mean, the scoreline was superb and we're playing Newcastle and I did fear a repeat of the performance in the game that we had at St James's Park at the end of last season. But I do take his point. As good as the scoreline was, there were times when we weren't really firing on all cylinders. Now, AD and I had a conversation after the game. I think he was very, very slightly upset with the performance of João Pedro. Now, a lot of the pundits have said, well, he had a really good game. But what I felt was that his approach play was really good. It was his final decision making and he wasn't really linking up with Ferguson. To be honest, Ferguson was just as guilty of not linking up with Pedro. It's just obviously Ferguson's going to get the plaudits because he stuck the ball away and Pedro didn't. So there's work there to be had as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, with Pedro, I mean, I did have a bit of a downer on him after the game because, I mean, the team, to my eyes, played fantastically well. And I just don't think he was up to the standards of everyone else in that particular game.
I think that actually, again, he did actually, where Ferguson was spinning his man, so was Pedro. It's just that when he got to the edge of the area, it just all fell apart. And as if to say, have you two been playing together? I'm actually looking at the pair of them here.
Yeah.
The fact that Ferguson scored the hat-trick, I wouldn't say it means he got away with it, but because obviously it's a brilliant, brilliant achievement. But I thought they were just as culpable of each other as not linking up with each other as well as they could have done.
But the other really exciting thing from this game as well for me was the return of Tarek Labdi. I mean, how good was he when he got back on that grass? It was just so wonderful to see him and to see that he hasn't lost any of that speed, Dave.
Yeah, well, it's brilliant, isn't he? He's a player that was so good when he first came in, wasn't he? I'm not sure how he fits into a back four. That was always the kind of worry for me because I just think no matter how sort of fast you are and whether you're a good defender and everything else, it's quite difficult to be Tarek Lamptey's size and that not to be sort of picked on as a weakness, really, by teams at the level we're at. So, you know, I do wonder about that and whether he's a right back, but obviously, he came on in that more advanced position, and you just feel, you know, I hope that there is a role for him there, you know, at certain moments in certain games. And obviously, that the certain moment in that game was that Dan Burn had been booked, and what a great decision to send on a guy that's, basically nobody can touch. Cher, if you'd have caught him, Cher should have been probably booked for that attempt to cripple him anyway.
Which would have been a
red card. So it was a great opportunity to use him. And I really hope that they can find a way to use him because it's a waste of a player who's too good to be wasted, really, if we can't somehow integrate him, I think.
I did laugh when the entire West Stand went up expecting the clatter. And then you realise actually he's just gone sailing past him and made him look an absolute mug. I mean, and also you look at it, you think, well, we start the game with Matoma and March and finish the game with Adingra and Lamptey. And Newcastle must be going, well, we don't deserve this. You know, as brilliant as Lamptey was and his ball across the area, I actually was screaming at Matoma, why didn't you stick it away? And I didn't realise that Trippier had actually made a very, very timely interception, and that was actually really well done. But we have to mention the Bruggen absolutely mugging off Anthony Gordon. I mean, I could see him herring across the pitch, Anthony Gordon towards the ball. It was along the lines of, I've had enough of being, you know, messed about here. I'm just going to go and get the ball. The Bruggen saw him. He must have seen him a mile out and just went, ooh, bye. I mean, funny or what?
It was, Darren?
Yeah, that was funny. But let's not forget the save he made from Dunk's
brilliant
attempt. Well, could have been an own goal. That was important. I think it was 0-0 at that point.
Yeah.
So it's not a game that he was massively influential on, but his input was vital for the times that we needed him, and his distribution as well. You know, I mean,
for a guy in his only second Premier League game, he does look very comfortable in between the sticks for us, doesn't he?
Go on, Darren.
Yeah,
and that's on the back of his debut losing 3-1.
Yeah.
To put that kind of performance in was very impressive.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and he was excellent with his feet all game as well, wasn't he, Def?
Yeah, I think he instills real confidence, doesn't he? Which, you know, I thought Robert Sanchez was a good keeper, but there were times when you didn't have the most confidence that, you know, he might just drop a clanger at some point. And I think, you know, Verbruggen, it's very early days, isn't it? But he looks like an upgrade. He's so calm, fantastic with his feet. We saw that in the preseason friendlies, I think, where he was sort of pinging these, you know, amazing passes out to right to someone's foot on the halfway line. I think he got one wrong at the weekend, but yeah, he can, you know, he's brilliant. He can really play. And the save that he made that Darren mentioned really showed as well. His reaction's fantastic.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there is basically a fag pay between him and Jason Steele. I've got no problem with either of them playing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Before we move on, I just want to point out something which I saw Lewis Dunk do, which was basically after the final whistle, he ran out straight over to the referee and made sure that he got that match ball for Evan Ferguson. Which was absolutely delightful. But anyway, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We are, as ever, with you in association with the brilliant oldfootballshirts.com, and Phil has given us an absolute beauty of a shirt this week. So who would like to have a go at describing this little chemise?
Shall I? Okay. It's blue.
That's it.
Okay, all right, that's all we need to know. It's clearly early 80s. It's Adidas. It's got the three stripes down the sleeve.
The trefoil, yeah.
It's got the trefoil on a logo. It's got the collars that you could actually take off. I mean, this is possibly where Darren might actually want one of these shirts, where he could actually fly himself to Amsterdam in one of these collars. The badge itself looks like it's kind of got there is a name to it. I want to say an iron cross, but it's that iron cross shape. It's an advertisement. The sponsor is Imperio Seguros, which says to me kind of something Spanish, but the badge makes me think of a Maltese cross. So if I'm going to guess, one, it's from 1981. Two, it's a team from Malta. So let's say Valletta.
It's not from 1981 and it's not from Malta. Dave.
I've sort of, that badge kind of looks vaguely familiar, and I'm thinking Portugal, but I don't really know why. And I don't know.
You would be correct in Portugal. Club.
Yeah, Portugal sort of. So I'll take a punt. So it's not going to be Sporting. So it's probably going to be someone small, isn't it? So, well,
Phil
actually,
does have a habit of doing small second and third team shirts.
Right. Well, I'm going to go for it not being Benfica or Sporting because it's too obvious. And in that case, I might have more than one guess. So I'm going to go for Boa Vista.
It's not Boa Vista. Any ideas, Dave? Darren?
Well, I actually thought it was an Irish shirt.
I can see why you think that, but I'll put you out of your misery.
Can I have one more?
Go on.
Well, I don't know why, but I'm just going to go because I feel like this might be the sort of Vitória Guimarães.
No, it is not.
Oh. I just felt like it needed to be, you know,
obscure third division side that doesn't exist anymore.
You're close, actually, but this is what Phil has to say, and this is your shirt of the week, and it's chosen because it is gorgeous. This is the 1985-86 home shirt of Portuguese Liga 2 side OS Belenenses. Last season, they gained promotion from Liga 3. They are nicknamed O Belém, which translates to be the Bethlehem, and they were formed in 1919, and they play at the 19,856 capacity Estádio do Restelo in the city of Lisbon on the west coast of Portugal. Honours include the Primeira League title in 1946 when they beat Benfica by a point. And in domestic cups in the past, they've won the Taça de Portugal on three occasions and the Campeonato de Portugal on three occasions as well. A few links to the UK. Midfielder Emerson played for both Middlesbrough and Rangers. He also spent two seasons with Belen says between 1992 and 1994. Centre half Bruno Fernandes was with the side for 4 years at the turn of the century. He fashioned a non-league career in the UK with Drawlston, Workington and Seffin Druids. And for the big one, the shrinking violet, that is Jose Mourinho. He spent a season with Belen says reserve team in the 1982 to 1983 season. Sadly, Phil was unable to find a link to the Albion, but they really do have some fabulous kits and they're well worth checking out on oldfootballshirts.com. So thank you for that, Phil. Of course, you can see this and all the other Belenenses kits and over 130,000 others over at oldfootballshirts.com. So, Al, what's happening on the 17th of September?
We're getting drunk. Sorry.
Well, that's not unusual.
No, we'll try not to, seeing as it's so early in the day. Radio Reverb is a community-based radio station. We don't have a commercial license. We don't have a public broadcast license. We have a community license, which means we cannot accept funding through advertising. We can only get donations, grants, and sponsorship. So to that end, we're going to have a fundraising weekend. Where it's going to be loads and loads of people who work at the station. When I say work at the station, everyone at the Radio Reverb is a volunteer to do a whole load of live shows in order to raise funds for the station for this brilliant community-based project. Our slot is going to be midday till one on Sunday the 17th at the Hope and Ruin. Who knew that we could do a radio show in a pub? It's a match made in Hull. So do pop along if you want to come along and see how AD and I really function badly, I think is the word you want to use. Come along and heckle. If you really want to heckle that much, then why not come in and join and be part of the show? So yeah, do please pop along. Hope and Ruin, 17th of September. We're on air from live from midday till one. We haven't done a live show for about, well, probably since the last Reverbathon, so it's going to be fun in a way that's terrifying. But please do.
I'm not terrified at all. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be good.
Yeah, are you going to be A, sober and B, there on time?
It's on a midday. What did we take me for?
Oh yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, but yes, do please pop along. It'd be okay. Great to see you there.
Another thing. Go on now.
No, it'd be great to see you there. If you've got a few shekels, down the back of the sofa, then do send them our way.
And of course, you can always go to radioreverb.com and always just hit that big old donate button at any time as well. Now, Al, you're also in action next Wednesday at the Exeter Street Hall.
Yeah, can I just say in action is two words, not one word here. Nick Japanik, our good friend who's on the show every now and again, he hosts a sports panel evening. People can come along and ask questions of, well, actually I was about to say the esteemed panel, four-fifths of it are esteemed, the other one's me, which is very good, very nice of him to invite me along. But yes, at Exeter Street Hall, do pop along. It's on Wednesday the 13th of September, starts at 7:30. Tickets are a tenner, which you can get online from the Exeter Street Hall website. So if you want an evening of informed debate, or in my case, ill-informed debate, then do pop along and it'd be great to see you.
Okay. And finally, on notice board, in case you haven't picked up on it, I had a lovely chat with Gillian Balagay last week about our new signing, Ansu Fati, and he gave us the full lowdown about how the move came about and what the Spanish perception is of the Albion. So that's, of course, on over on our... What site's it on now?
It's on our Audio Boom podcast.
It's on the Audio Boom site, and it is also wherever you get your podcast as well. We've put it everywhere.
But talking of Spain, and I appreciate you didn't necessarily touch on it. Up yours, Jorge. Up yours, REFEF. You're an appalling organisation, and sacking your women's team manager is not going to change a thing. I felt I've had to say this, you know, we it's not as though we're going to sit on the fence, and it's not as though we're going to affect anything. But I think that the way that the Spanish FA has carried on, even now, finally having seen the light towards their women's team, their brilliant women's team, I think has been an absolute disgrace. And let's hope that not just them, but any women's team don't have to suffer that kind of nonsense again.
I totally agreed here. I'm sure everyone else agrees. Now, Darren, you've had a busy old time of it of late. Now, obviously, apparently we've got three games coming up on the continent, and you've been looking at trying to get people over there.
Yeah, I've been working really hard since Saturday morning. Been working both on the flights and both on and the coach travel as well. And for Marseille, it's challenging, mainly because we're talking about 4 weeks away. So all the Eurotunnel slots for Marseille for coaches have been taken, and the flight slots have also been taken for chartered flights. So for a little old Seagull travel, we're finding it really difficult to get something together off the ground for Marseille, but we have tried really, really hard. Slightly more positive with Ajax, in so much as I have been able to book some Eurotunnel slots, not on the game day, but it'd be the day before and the day after. So a couple of nights stay in en route somewhere, still to be decided. And the flight charter people we're working with are a bit more positive about Ajax, simply because that's November, later on in the year. So the timing of the first away game against Marseille has been challenging.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we've known we've been in Europe for a little while, but because of when the draw is and when the games are, it's really, really difficult to get, particularly for those earlier ones. It's very difficult to get the logistics in place, isn't it?
It is from, obviously we're doing this for the first time. From our experience here, it's not been a pleasant one because we're relying on people. And when you see the flight costs for EasyJet, for example, close to £500 now, and you can't even fly back the same day. Those flights were £125 before the weekend. So it is supply and demand, but we are where we are. But it is frustrating. The home service of the three European games is fine. We have total control over that. We had already lined up all of our coach companies. It's just the away travel has been challenging.
Are you in a position, and I don't know if it's something that you intend to do, are you in a position to offer, say, supposing those coming over from Amsterdam or from Marseille or from Athens, onward travel for those that are going to be flying into Gatwick? Is that part of the service that you can offer?
At the moment, we've been looking the other way around. So when we have away days, we've been looking to get people from the South Coast up to Gatwick. That's another service we're looking for. At doing, and we are working with Sussex Police to possibly explore getting away supporters down to the Amex. But the problem is, we've already got 50 coaches we're using for our home service at the same time. So logistically, it is very challenging. It would have been very easy for me to say we're not even considering away travel and just focus on what we know best. But we're looking at the long haul, and hopefully, we'll see many seasons of Brighton being in Europe.
So that's exactly the question I was going to ask, Darren. I mean, obviously, it is a very, very steep learning curve. As you said, we've not ever had to do this before. And and the lead-in times are particularly challenging. But the other thing would be, I mean, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves, but for some reason, the bookies have got us favourites for the group, which doesn't mean anything, because football's obviously paid on grass, not in the betting shop. And
with third favourites for the entire tournament.
If we were to progress, I mean, do you know what would the lead-in times be for the next rounds?
Well, the only definite date we know and the definite venue we know is Dublin at this point.
Booked.
It's as simple as that. And we are looking at securing ferry slots with cancellation periods in there. For Dublin, because that's the only thing we have any certainty over. Obviously, we've got to qualify and get through to the stages. But in the group stages, we're almost in the same position because we don't know where we'll be playing home or away and what dates.
Yeah.
So it is very challenging.
So you mentioned...
Darren, it must be really difficult for you because people don't know obviously whether they've even got tickets yet. So that must put you kind of in a bit of a sort of a circular loop. I know it's difficult with the loyalty points and everything for the club. It's a minefield as to how they distribute this. But is there a way to do that that would help you if people could, you know, sort of earlier on buy a flight seat that guarantees a ticket, something like that? Because you must be kind of stuck in a between a rock and a hard place on that score.
Well, as official fans travel supplier for the club, we have an onus to ensure that those people that book with us have a match ticket.
Right.
So that
but no one's got one yet.
No one's got a match ticket yet. So it's easier for the traditional home and away games in the Premier League. You know, we're just going to transport people that got match tickets. Of course, for the likes of Marseille, Athens, we could potentially be taking people that haven't got a match ticket. But if you wait to try and put something together until the match tickets are ready, you're too late.
Mm. So surely from a practical point of view going forward, you do need to, regardless of how the club manages to get around that, you need a situation perhaps where you do say, if you book, you get a ticket.
Yeah, well...
But it's not easy to work out, I know, because lots of noses will be out of joint and every, you know, no one's ever going to be... There's no good way of doing it, is there? There's never going to be a way that pleases everyone, but it must be really tough.
At the moment, we had discussions with the club a good few months ago about the fact that it was guaranteed that any package we put together would not include the match ticket.
Mm.
We knew very early on that a match ticket wasn't included. So, if a match ticket was included, it'd be a bit easier, but it's not, and we respect that decision.
Sure.
It's very difficult. Now, the commercial flights on Saturday were working out at 650 ahead. Well, when you compare that to the commercial price, it was 150 at that time. So if you go to market with a charter price of 650 ahead, you're on a hiding to nothing, because people will be saying that our charter people are making money out of this. How can they do that? Now we're in a position where the charter people have gone to book that plane today. It's no longer available at a time when the commercial price is £500 a seat.
Yeah, so sure.
There's not actually much difference between the two now.
I mean, Darren, you've mentioned Eurostar and you've mentioned charter flights. I mean, did you look up, presumably, if you looked at boats as well, at ferries across?
Yeah, the ferries we have looked at, obviously, everyone's aware that there's a coach driver shortage at the moment. So every trip that we go on, there'll be two drivers going at the same time where the coach company's got school contracts to maintain. So we're taking vehicles out of the country, two drivers, every vehicle, when that driver should be doing school work. All those issues with 4 weeks' notice, it's just so many things against us just at this time.
But, go on, Al.
Sorry, Darren, you mentioned about the issues obviously with Marseille and such a short lead-in time, and you think you got a bit more hope for the Amsterdam trip. What about Athens, which I think is the last of the... Is it not the last of the away
yes,
games?
Yes, it is, yeah.
I mean, obviously you've got a longer lead-in time. I think it's the beginning of December. So even from here, so we're talking, 3 months away, how's it looking? Have you started, sort of looking into those things as well?
If I'm to be honest, it's not realistic for coach travel. So we're purely looking at flights, and I'm in the hands of the air charter teams. But they have been discussing it. Even to the point where they might have to add a little bit extra for whether the plane needs de-icing and all that, because it's a November flight. So we have started that discussions, but until everything's signed and delivered, I can't comment.
Well, all I would ever say is, if you rewind 60 years, Cliff Richard managed to make it from London to Athens in a London Routemaster. So,
yeah, I think North Stand Chat said on Saturday or Friday, heard a rumour that we'd already started departing for Athens. And I replied saying, yes, but someone's forgot their passport.
Yeah.
So there's so many things that, I just hope everyone's got their passport in place. Everyone's got travel insurance, because all these kind of questions, if you arrive at the ferry, Eurotunnel, and you've got no passport, we can't wait or get you home. You're there. So,
Okay, Dave.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to make Darren feel a bit better because I did a game once between Metalist Kharkiv and Everton, and we flew to we flew out the day before the game. We flew via Vienna to Kiev, and then we stayed in Kiev overnight, and then we got a minibus from Kiev to Kharkiv, which took about 8 hours. I had to run about the last 400 meters to the ground or something because we were kind of stuck in traffic. There's not much between Kiev and Kharkiv. As soon as you get out of the city, it's kind of like these little single lane roads, literally with sort of horses and goats and stuff wandering around on them. So we spent 8 hours on this minibus. I did the game. I had to sort of run to the ground the last bit to speak to, I think David Moyes was the manager at the time. And then it was straight back on the minibus afterwards. We stopped at about 4 a.m. and the production guy who was on the coach said to us, right, good news, we're at the hotel. So we're like, fantastic, we finally get some kip because we've literally been going since like God knows what time the previous morning. And he said, bad news is we got to leave at 6. So it's like 2 hours later because otherwise we won't be able to get the flight back from Kiev. Mm. So, the whole thing was a disaster. I saw people get more drunk in that 2 hours than I would have thought was humanly possible. We got near Kiev airport and the guy stopped the minibus by the side of the road and basically said, I'm not going any further until you pay me in cash. So what I'm saying basically, Darren, is Seagull Travel is definitely going to be better than that. And I think everyone's really grateful for what you do. So, that's it. So if anybody moans, point it my way and I'll say, look, you don't know you're born. Yeah, that's a proper European trip.
No, I appreciate that. No, I was going to talk about Marseille in particular. Obviously, it's been documented that people need to go to a location to pick up their ticket before the game.
Bubble style?
I don't know. But equally, we've been told that, and I think it's been public knowledge, that fans are likely to be able to stay in the ground after the game.
Right.
So if that delay in getting out of the ground and then going back to another location, if that's the case, to be bused back to a ticket collection point, trying to get a flight under that time pressure, it's just so tight to do there and back in the day. So you're looking at a hotel option. To get a hotel for 180 people at this point in Marseille, it's just not going to happen. So there's so many challenges, which with just 4 weeks' notice, it's just too not possible.
Not that I'm trying to tell you how to do your job here, but has anyone considered flying either to Nice or Montpellier? Because they're not far away and the train service in between isn't that bad. Or is it the case that the collection point for the ticket means that ideally you basically have to fly to Marseille and you're going to get ferried around?
It's too much of an unknown. And now I'm pretty sure the club and Darren Balkan will be going over there soon to have a recce. But we're talking days away or maybe a week away, by which time the landscape's changed so much.
Mm.
Now, had it been a traditional home game, Liverpool, we know the process. We've got no idea going to Marseille.
Mm.
So, lot to learn very quickly.
Absolutely. No, listen.
Well, there is a port in Marseille, right? You know, we'll just get a boat from New Hope. Actually, do it from Brighton Marina, and we'll leave now. We might get there in time. Maybe do it on a pedalo. Or is that?
Yes.
Okay, and that is all we've got time for this week. So thank you to Darren Gallis from Seagulls Travel for coming and telling us about what's happening with Europe. Thank you to Dave Beckett. Thank you to Alan Wares. I've been Ailey Packham. This has been the Albion Roar on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB, of course on a podcast, and in association with AllFootballShirts.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you all again next week. Cheers. Bye.
Joy, 3 for a girl and 4 for a boy, 5 for silver, 6 for gold, 7 for a secret never to be told, 8 to wish and 9 a kiss, 10 is a bird you must not miss, 1 for sorrow, 2 for joy, 3 for a girl and 4 for a boy. Yeah.
5 for silver, 6 for gold.